class.
Yeah, you came last class, right?
This is like, I took equity value already, but I really like your way of teaching.
Okay. So welcome, sir.
I'm about to say.
All three of you are together?
No, I'm just Louis Lopez and Thomas Gallagher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm right there.
Nice to meet you. So sit up in front if you can.
Could you perhaps use this thing?
You don't have it online because that's a pain in the neck to get your projecting because you have to turn off the projector and stuff. Okay. I'd be glad to. Okay. Absolutely.
I'd be glad to.
Send it to me. We'll wait till it gets to 2 and then get people's attention because otherwise they won't hear you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Could I just have a moment, please? Excuse me. Hi. So, a quick announcement. This is a laptop drive that the Stone International Volunteers Program here is doing, and we are part of that. And while you and I may have laptops and computers that we can't live without every day, there's a lot of people, like especially in Africa and other countries, that don't have any computers. So we're doing a laptop drive where we would love for you or anyone you know to donate their old, unused laptops to a better cause. It's very simple. Like, you can just take my email down. I'm going to post this outside. And just email me. And if you have old or unused laptops, instead of selling them for pennies on the dollar, you could donate them to the Stone International Volunteers Program in Ghana. You'd really be helping out for a great cause. So if anyone's interested, anyone has old, unused computers or laptops that are still functional, please check it out. This is going to be posted around Stern. Thank you for your time.
Welcome. So I noticed there are about 50 quizzes that haven't been picked up. What do you plan to do with those? They're not going away, right? I mean, I think there's actually, you can tie this to, there's this old notion in economics that what you don't know is not happening. You can't live in the real world. It's happened, you might as well pick it up. Because at least if I've screwed up, you can point it out to me. So if you haven't picked up your quizzes, please do, right? Because it's good for you to at least see where you made the mistakes and good for you to spot mistakes I've made so we can fix it before we move on. Second, you know that spring break is coming a week and a half from now, right? This is the good news. There is some bad news, though. It's not really bad news. It's neutral news. Remember that feedback that I told you I would give you on your DCF? Have you checked when that DCF has to be turned in to me to get the feedback? It's a week after you come back from spring break. Which means if you haven't picked a company yet, this is not going to happen. So stop hedging. Pick a damn company and move on, because you're like Hamlet sitting there, what should I do? What should I go? And like Hamlet, you're going to come to a bad end. So pick a company and just get started. Right? There are at least a dozen people who asked me today, and this has nothing to do with the class. They're very confused. Because last week I was wearing a sweatshirt. You remember that? It was a UCLA sweatshirt. You're saying, what the hell happened here? How do you go from being a Bruin to a Bear? I did go to school at UCLA, but I started my teaching at Cal. I've been at NYU 31 years. You're saying, why the hell are you wearing UC sweatshirt still? Couple of reasons. One is I don't like violet, which is a problem if you have any NYU. And the second is I love college sports. So I'll make a deal with you. When I see NYU in the Final Four of the NCAA, I'll wear an NYU sweatshirt. We might be waiting a long time. It might be like as long as Northwestern students have been waiting for Northwestern to get in the NCAA, which is like 50-something years, 60 years, finally this year they might. So let's get to the matter at hand. Today we're going to complete our discussion of terminal value. Okay? And I'm going to ask you a couple of start of the class questions, kind of get the basis nailed down. And then we're going to go into what I call the loose ends in valuation. Essentially, all the things you do after you tell me you're done. So let's start with a couple of questions about terminal value. Okay? Let's assume that I ask you to compute the terminal value for a company. The cash flows are going to be the after-tax operating income and the cash flow for this company are going to be $100 million every year forever. And the cost of capital for this company is 10%. Zero growth. What's the terminal value of this company? $1 billion, you said, right? Which is $100 million divided by 0.10. Everybody agree with that? It's just a perpetuity. Present value of perpetuity is the cash flow divided by the discount rate. Now comes the question, which is a little tricky. Let's see if you can answer it. So the previous example, there was no growth. If I put in a 2% growth rate forever, which of the following will happen to the terminal value? You don't even have to give me a number. Will it go up, go down, not change? None of the above, which is a kind of strange way to, because if it's none of the above, I don't know where you're going, right? But you won't be so confusing. I have no idea. Maybe it becomes one of the, you know, and how in math you spend entire sessions on numbers that don't exist. I've never understood imaginary numbers, as if we don't have enough trouble with real numbers that we actually have. But mathematicians are strange, so they think. And maybe it's any of the above. What do you think will happen if I throw in a growth rate into this equation? You're saying it's going to go up. In fact, most people would say that, right? Why? Because you're thinking about R minus G, and I'm now putting a G. Actually, that's not the right answer. Why? That's kind of unfair to ask you why when I've given you the answer. But why is it not that straightforward? When I had no growth, what were my cash flows? I took my after-tax operating income, and I paid them out as cash flows. Why was I able to do that? Because I was not growing. I didn't have to put any of the money back into the business, so I was able to pay out the cash flow. You've now put in a 2% growth rate. Growth doesn't happen by magic, right? To grow, what do you have to do? You have to reinvest. And how much will you have to reinvest? That's what's going to determine whether my terminal value is going to go up, down. And today we're going to crack the code on that particular secret. Because if you get that, then in a sense you have a much better grasp of terminal value than people who just plug the numbers into an equation and go with it. So let's turn to page 195 in your lecture notes, because that's where I left you last session. So I was talking about capping the growth rate in perpetuity at less than the growth rate of the economy, right? I said no company can grow faster than the economy. I don't care how great you are as a company, eventually your growth rate has to come down to below the growth rate of the economy. And I left you with this potential way of getting the cap, which is look at the risk-free rate. So I'm going to start with defending that proposition, because that's not something that is widely used. It's a proposition that I've come up with that I defend, I feel is a good way of capping the growth. So let me defend why I think the risk-free rate is a good way of thinking about nominal growth in the economy. To the left, I have the risk-free rate. And if you think about decomposing or breaking down the risk-free rate, you can write it as expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate, right? That's a Fisher equation. To the right, I have the nominal growth rate in the economy, which is written as expected inflation plus an expected real growth rate. So you have two equations. If you take a look at those two equations, the expected inflation is in both of them. And when I use the risk-free rate as a proxy for growth, I'm essentially saying real interest rates have to be equal to real growth rates in the long term. And I'm going to back that up, both theoretically and empirically. Do you remember your econ class where you talked about real interest rates? No, right? I don't either. But I vaguely remember them talking about apples. And I remember thinking, why the hell are you talking about apples? Because when you talk about real interest rates, you talk in terms of goods and services. You borrow 100 apples today, you're supposed to return 102 apples a year from now because the person lending the apples is giving up current consumption. Real interest rates are in terms of goods and services. So if I tell you that the real interest rate in an economy is 2%, and if the real growth is only 1% in the economy, do you see what the problem you're going to run into is? You promise people 2% more in goods and services, but if you're growing only 1%, you can't deliver that 2%. So in the long term, real GDP growth has to be at least equal to the real interest rate to be able to deliver that real interest rate. It is possible that real growth could be higher than the real interest rate. But let's look at the actual numbers. Here's what I did. I went back all the way to 1954. And I looked at the average T-bond rate over that period. So over the entire period from 1954 through 2015, the T-bond rate was about 5.93%. The average inflation rate over the period was 3.61%. The real GDP growth over the period was 3.06%. You add those two numbers up, my nominal GDP growth over the last 60 years has been about 6.6%. My T-bond rate has been about 5.9%. In fact, I'll go further. Over the last 50 years, the best predictor of growth over the next 10 years is not some famous macroeconomist. It's the T-bond rate. You take the T-bond rate in every period, and you look at the next 10 years. The T-bond rate has been a better predictor of nominal growth over the next 10 years than any single economic forecast, which is incredibly bad news if you think about your future, right? Why? What are T-bond rates at right now? 2.4%. Whatever you think about T-bonds, the bond market is saying, I don't care whatever plans you have, your nominal GDP growth is going to be 2.4. And you should only be thankful you don't live in Japan, right? Because what's the T-bond rate in Japan telling you? The yen bond rate is actually negative. Which means that if you trust the bond rate, what do you getting as expected nominal growth in Japan over the next decade? A negative number. And there's a reason for that. You've got an aging population, you've got increased pension fund, you know, and healthcare costs, you've got a smaller and smaller proportion of the population that's actually working. There's a reason why Japanese nominal growth is getting negative. And Europe is not far behind Japan, right? The euro bond rate is what, 0.3%, 0.2%? There's a message in the risk-free rate which we ignore at our own peril. And that's part of the reason when I look at the risk-free rate and I use that as a basis for building my discount rates, it's also going to re-enter my valuation when I talk about growth. You don't buy it? I'll give you another reason why the risk-free rate should be used as your growth rate. One of the things people always, I mean, especially today when you talk to people, they talk about how low risk-free rates are today. Risk-free rates are low. How low? It depends on how old you are. Right? If you're 60 years old, rates look really low because when you were in the market, when you enter, there's actually behavioral finance, there's this finding that might be well worth remembering. What you observe in the world between the age of 30 and 35 becomes your frame of reference for the rest of your life. Those people who are 30 to 35 during the Great Depression spent the rest of their lives acting as if the Great Depression continued for 60 years. They saved cans, didn't throw away paper, because that's the... It might not be rational. You might be now a wealthy person, but 30 to 35... So if you entered the market in the 1980s, when the T-bond rate was 7%, your frame of reference is a reasonable T-bond rate is 7%. What the hell is going on? 2.45%, it's too low. But let's say you're right, T-bond rate is too low. Is it helping you in evaluation when you have a low risk-free rate? Hey, cost of capital just came down, right? The only way to preserve consistency in your valuation is whatever risk-free rate you're assuming now has to enter in the growth rate. In other words, if you assume low risk-free rates, then the only growth rate in perpetuity that's consistent with a low risk-free rate is a low growth rate. What will destroy your valuations is if you use a 2.45% risk-free rate to get a cost of capital, and then when you estimate growth, you go and use a 60-year growth from the last 60 years of 6%. Or 5.93%. Your valuation is going to blow up. Why? Because you're assuming a different economy for your cash flows than you are for your discount rate. So I know it sounds rigid, and I tried to build in some wiggle room there, but I know, and this is me, maybe you're stronger than me, I know that if I let myself break that rule of letting the growth rate exceed the risk-free rate, then I'm going to let my biases very quickly find a way into my valuation. So I want Snap to be worth $25 billion. All I have to do is sit there with the 2.45, make it 2.73, 3.2. I'll get there. And that's part of the reason I don't want you to mess with that growth rate, because you've lost the integrity of your valuation when you let that become a number that you can just make up. If you get a chance, take a look at the post I wrote about Evercore's valuation of Tesla. I've mentioned this before. And if you remember, what was the big issue I had with them? I called them inept. And this is one of the, it's a boutique investment bank, very smart people. And there are a few people there. Actually, I was in the building a couple of weeks ago in the Evercore building. And I got into the elevator and there were two Evercore bankers on there. I wasn't sure whether I should stay in the elevator or get up and walk up the stairs. But they were pissed off. I said, you know, why do you call? And the reason I called that valuation inept is they assumed a growth rate of 6% a year forever for Tesla. And that's not a sustainable valuation. If you got to 6%, the whole value, there are no other assumptions that even matter because your valuation is kind of blown up internally. So cap the growth rate. Any questions on capping the growth rate? Which also means if you're valuing a company in Japanese yen, you're going to get to a very uncomfortable point, right? Because when you get to steady state, your maximum growth rate has to be a negative number. It's okay. It's okay. Nothing bad is going to happen. Just stay with it, because that same low, the negative growth rate, you're going to be helped out by having a negative risk-free rate. So it's going to even out. And that's the key in valuation. Second advice on the terminal value. When you sit down to value a company, I'm going to ask you, when will your company become a mature company? If you're valuing Toyota, what's the answer to that? It's already a mature company. When it's Yahoo, what is the answer to that? That was 20 years ago, right? When I ask you that about Snap, now we're talking about uncertainty. It's going to be sometime in the future, but sometime in the future is not a number you can enter into an Excel spreadsheet. So I have a question for you. You're valuing a young company like Snapchat. It's a star. Everybody loves the company. They think it's got great potential. And you're trying to decide when to make it a mature company. And I'll give you some choices, and you tell me which of these choices you would go with. You could say, look, I'm going to use 3, 4, 5 years. Maybe you'll round it at 5, maybe you'll go to 10, or maybe you'll use a period greater than 10 years. Now think about it. Instinctively, what do you want to do? You think it's a young company, lots of potential, millions of users, 25 minutes a day on Snap. You're going to be tempted to say, let's use 15, 20, 25 years. So I have a question for you. Are there companies that have grown for longer than 10 years? It's not a trick question. Obviously, right? Like who? You could start IBM, you know, Microsoft, Google, Facebook even, you know, if you think about it, it's getting close to 10 years. What does the fact that we can name these companies tell you about these companies? That they are the exception, right? It's like saying, can you name players who hit more than 50 home runs? Yes, on one hand. And three of them have taken steroids. So even they're left with two fingers. You see where I'm going? You can't value a company to be the exception. Could Snap be the next Google? Yes. But do I want to value Snap on the expectation it's going to be the next Google? Not in this lifetime, because then what's my upside, right? Because if I value you to be an exceptional company, and you're just a very, very good company, it's a negative, it's a bad surprise, right? I have never used more than 10 years in a DCF valuation precisely for that reason. Why 10 years? I actually have this data set of how long growth has lasted at a typical growth company in the US going back for the last 50 years. You know what the median growth period for a growth company in the US is? It's 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years, you're pretty much done. 10 years, you're already at the 90th percentile. I'm putting you at the 90th percentile with 10 years, and I'm willing to do that with Snap, but I'm not going to go 25 or 40. So my suggestion is, when you feel this urge to keep extending your growth period, use some caution. It's very difficult to grow for longer than 5, 7, 8, or 10 years. Yes? I'm sorry? Why would it not? I mean, I'm going to give them the potential that I expect them to have over a reasonable growth period. So the next 10 years. For Snap, I gave them a 55% revenue growth and margins going from minus 100% to plus 25%. Hey, I'm giving them a lot of benefit from potential, right? Because right now, what do they have? Nothing. They have a $500 million in revenues and a $500 million in losses. I'm making that into $12 billion in revenues and $3 billion in profits. Those profits are coming from the potential. What I'm not giving them is the potential of being an exceptional company, which means 25 years of growth, because could that happen? Yes. But if it happens, I want it to be icing on the cake for me as an investor. I don't want to build it in as an expectation up front. And when you think about, you know, this, how long you should let companies grow, think about what creates value. When we talked about growth, we talked about when growth creates value, when it's neutral, when it destroys value. Do you remember that discussion? For growth to create value, what has to be true? The return on capital you make has to be greater than the cost of capital, right? And that's just, it's saying, so what? In economic terms, I'm basically saying you have some kind of a competitive advantage. In a perfectly competitive market, excess returns go to zero instantaneously. So the very fact that I'm assuming you can make more than the cost of capital must mean that I think you have some competitive advantages and that you can sustain them. Remember we said valuation is about storytelling? When you value a company like Snap, whether you like it or not, you got to tell me in your story what you think their competitive advantages, what your barriers to entry are. Because that's what's going to allow their growth. Because I can give them 150% revenue growth, but if they earn their cost of capital on all that growth, it's meaningless. So that's the other half of the puzzle, is what are the company's competitive advantages and how long will they last? And here's the bottom line. The stronger your competitive advantages and the more sustainable they are, the longer my growth period can be. So let's start easy. If I gave you a company like Coca-Cola, what's its competitive advantage? Somebody said the secret syrup. Who cares about the syrup? I mean, let's face it, Coca-Cola doesn't even taste the same in different countries. Have you gone to Mexico and drank the Coke? It tastes entirely different. In fact, for a brief moment in history, they thought that taste actually mattered. In the mid-80s. You remember that? They introduced it. You can't remember. You weren't even born. But they introduced new Coke, and then they went back to old Coke. It's the stupidest dance ever. Because nobody cares what the taste is. So let me ask the question again. What's Coca-Cola's strong competitive advantage? Brand name. And where does brand name come from? God only knows. It's a mystery. But does brand name last? It is one of the strongest competitive advantages known to man. So with Coca-Cola, I know what the competitive advantage is. I know it's strong and sustainable, so I feel comfortable letting them grow for 5 or 7 or 8 or 10 years, even though they're a big company, because I can see what their competitive advantage is. Now let's turn to a social media company. What's Facebook's competitive advantage? One is lots of users, but so is Twitter. Users plus intensity. The average Facebook user spent 53 minutes a day on Facebook last year. 53 minutes a day. What are lives coming to? We spend 50 minutes on YouTube, 53 minutes on Facebook, 25 minutes on Snap. It's amazing we have time left for the rest of our lives. But I actually have an argument that this is the ultimate constraint, right? There's only so much time in the day, and the companies that will capture your time are going to capture the value. Is that a sustainable advantage? It's going to be very difficult because there's a networking benefit you get, right? Why do you go to Facebook? Because that's where you want to show off. You're going to go to the places where the most people hang out. What's the point of going to some site where there are only three people and showing off to two other people? You want to show off to 1.7 billion people how great you are? Of course, they're not all your friends, but you hope your friends have friends have friends have friends, and they go to China and it becomes a billion people. So there is a networking advantage. I can understand it's going to be very difficult for another. So, in fact, that's my biggest worry with Snap, right? Is they have to find their way to get into the space where Facebook and Google are already dominant, but that's a competitive advantage. With your company, you know what I'm talking mean by your company, right? The company that you hypothetically picked 6 weeks ago that you've been working on hypothetically for the last 6 weeks. It's not hypothetical. I know many of you have picked a company. That's a question I want you to ask. What is this company's competitive advantage? You see, that wasn't corporate strategy. This is corporate strategy made real because I'm going to make you tie this to your excess returns and your growth assumptions because ultimately that's what's going to drive why you let some companies grow for longer and others don't. And it was a reason when Groupon went public that I was very negative on Groupon because I could not understand its competitive advantage. The only thing I could think of is they got your email address first. That's all I could think of, right? Because right after they came out, you had Amazon deal of the day. So basically, Living Social, you had an incredible number of imitators, and there was nothing that Groupon could do to stop them because they didn't have that stickiness that Facebook has of keeping you within the network. So cap the growth rate. Second, make sure you don't let high growth continue too long. Third suggestion. Remember, growth is not free. So when you put in a growth rate in your terminal value equation, make sure you reinvest enough money to sustain that growth rate. And I'll give you a very simple way of estimating how much to reinvest. Remember we said growth is equal to return on capital times reinvestment rate? We did that in the context of estimating growth. Simple equation, right? Growth is reinvestment rate times return on capital. One equation, three variables. It's algebra. If I gave you two of the three variables, you should be able to estimate the third. Remember the example that we just did in class where I said, what if you have 2% growth? What if I told you that this company has a 10% return on capital? So I've given you the growth rate and the return on capital. What's the only unknown here? Your reinvestment rate, you can solve for it. Your reinvestment rate then has to be 20%. So when I do my cash flows, I'm going to set aside 20%. If you bring that into your valuation, your terminal value all of a sudden will get much more bounded. So when you change the growth rate, your cash flows will have to change, and how much they will change will depend on how high your return on capital is. When you ask people what the biggest assumption they make in the terminal value is, usually they say the growth rate. That's not true. Because you can change the growth rate and do nothing to your terminal value. You can change the growth rate and increase your terminal value. You can change the growth rate and decrease your terminal value. I took the example that we just did. And I changed the growth rate from 0% to 3%. But if my return on capital was 10%, my terminal value stayed unchanged as I went from 0% growth to 3% growth. Why? Because at a 10% return on capital, you're earning your cost of capital. In fact, let's tie this into corporate finance. If your return on capital is equal to your cost of capital, when I do a capital budgeting analysis and I come up with a net present value for your projects, what's your net present value going to be? If you earn your cost of capital, your net present value is going to be zero. When you take a project with a net present value of zero, how much does your value change? This isn't a trick question. It doesn't change. What if you take 100 projects with a net present value of zero? 100 times zero is zero. 1,000 projects, zero. Growth becomes useless if you set the return capital equal to the cost of capital. I wrote my first valuation book in the late 80s, and the publisher was John Wiley. And at the same time, John Wiley also published the McKinsey book on valuation. Both books came out at the same time. And the McKinsey, I love the McKinsey book on valuation, but in the terminal value chapter, the way they compute terminal value is they take EBIT times 1 minus T and divide by cost of capital. There's no growth in the equation. So people would look at the book, and they'd email me, to which my response is, why are you emailing me? Why did you email McKinsey? They thought we were all connected at the hip. We hung out in coffee shops together and talked valuation. Okay? How come there's no growth in the terminal value equation in the McKinsey book? And the answer is actually very simple. If you look at the McKinsey chapter on terminal value, they assume that when companies become mature, that their excess returns disappear. That a mature company cannot earn more than its cost of capital. Which means what? You're basically stuck in that middle column where growth doesn't matter. If growth doesn't matter, what can you do? Just assume the growth rate is zero. You're going to get the same terminal value as assuming a 2% growth rate or a 3% growth rate. Can growth destroy value? Of course. If I let my return on capital be less than the cost of capital and I add growth to the equation, my terminal value will actually get lower the more growth I put in. The big assumption in your terminal value calculation is not your growth rate, it's the excess returns you assume that go with that growth rate. And what will that depend on? What do you think this business looks like? When I valued Tesla, when I got to my steady state, my year 10, and you can see the Tesla valuation on the valuation of the week, I made the return on capital go to the cost of capital. Why? Because in the business they're in, which is this infrastructure automobile business, it's very difficult to make more than your cost of capital. But when I valued Facebook and Snap, I allowed the return on capital to be higher than the cost of capital because at least in the technology space, even after companies become mature, like Microsoft, they continue to earn more than the cost of capital. So I'd like to preserve that freedom and not assume it's zero excess returns for every company. And McKinsey itself, in its research, seems to find that my point of view has a little more basis than theirs because they actually track growth rates and excess returns at companies as they age. And as they age, they notice that growth rates converge in the growth rate of the economy. So that's actually basis for assuming terminal value. But they also notice that as companies age, their excess returns don't go to zero. They actually stay above zero, at least in some sectors. So when you look at your company, that's an option I give you. In fact, one of the defaults I ask you is, do you want me to make excess returns zero? And if you say no, I ask you, how much of an excess return do you think your company should make? Just make sure you bring it down. It can't be 20% excess returns forever. But you need to preserve that freedom of having some companies earn excess returns because of the kinds of businesses they're in. So cap the growth rate. Make sure you don't wait too long. And remember, you have to reinvest enough to sustain growth. And I'm going to deal with one very common set of assumptions I see in DCFs, which you will run into as well. And I want you to prepare you well for the arguments you will make when you run into these DCFs. So here's how it will go. You'll have an analyst say that your company has become a stable growth company, mature company. And he'll also say because it's a stable growth company, he's going to assume that CapEx offsets depreciation. Because mature companies don't need to reinvest, so CapEx offsets depreciation. So what does it make my net CapEx? CapEx offsets depreciation means my net CapEx is zero. He said working capital requirements are negligible, which makes my change in working capital zero. So if my net CapEx is zero and my change in working capital is zero, I'm reinvesting nothing. If I'm reinvesting nothing, my reinvestment rate is zero. You see the mathematical problem with these? Because if he assumes a 2% growth rate forever, and you have a 0% reinvestment rate, what will your return on capital have to be to equate those two numbers? Don't think too long. It can't happen. This is an impossible valuation. If you're going to assume a 2% growth rate forever, I don't care what kind of company it is, you need to reinvest something back into the company to get to that 2%. Don't tell me you can get away without reinvesting any money forever. To which the response the analyst will give, because I've had this conversation, is what if I just let them grow at the inflation rate? Do you see where his mind is going, right? If I grow at the inflation rate, I don't need to build extra capacity. If I don't need to build extra capacity, why would I need to reinvest? What's the answer to that? Can I grow at the inflation rate and not have to reinvest? Let's say I have a factory, right? The capacity, I don't have to increase, same number of products. Do the machines start to get old, though? I have to replace them. You're saying replacement doesn't go. The old machine goes away, new machine comes in. The only problem is if there's inflation in your output, there's probably inflationary inputs as well. The machine that cost $1,000 10 years ago is now costing $1,200. You can't selectively use inflation when you talk about the good stuff and ignore it in the bad stuff. There is no exception. So if there is growth, there has to be reinvestment. Yes?
Back on the previous slide, you're just running the same place forever.
Yeah.
In your experience, have you seen that obviously the price value gap that people and investors price in the stocks still will push the price up even though they're just running in place?
Could be. And it can happen. You know, when eventually the truth catches up. The way it catches up is they notice that the way it's getting the value up is by not delivering cash flows. It depends very much on the company. Some companies it happens instantaneously. Some companies happen 6 months before it happens. People start to build it in. Some companies you might have to wait 3 years. And I think it really varies across companies, which is one reason why intrinsic valuation makes sense, is for you to get ahead of the market in finding these companies. Any other questions? Final point. If you make your company a mature company, give it the characteristics of a mature company. Sounds like an abstraction, right? So let's say you're valuing a young company. Anybody valuing a young company here? Salesforce, right? Young company. So when you start the process, they probably have high revenue growth, probably low margins. They're like an Amazon-like company. They want to grow fast and not have margins. And you probably have high risk because it's a young growth company and there's lots of risk. Probably can't borrow money. Why? Because they're not making enough money to pay debt. So right now, if you ask me to look at Salesforce, in year one, I'm going to see high growth, low margins, high risk, low debt, high cost of capital. Okay, that makes sense. On your spreadsheet, what do you plan to do to Salesforce? You plan to grow them, and you plan to eventually make them a mature company, right? It'll happen, don't worry. So in year 10, you make Salesforce into a mature company. So now your revenue growth has come down. Your margins have improved. You're now a money-making mature company. Help me out here. What should happen to their risk as they become a mature company? It should be less risky. Can they borrow money now that they become a mature company? They should be able to borrow money now that they're a mature company. Their return on capital might actually have to come down towards the cost of capital because they're now part of the status quo. I can't leave the beta at 1.8 and my debt ratio at 2% as I make my company go from being a high growth company to a mature company because it's not fair to the company. I'm giving it lower growth. I have to give it the rest of the characteristics of growth. So one of the things you will notice in all my spreadsheets is my cost of capital starts at whatever you give me as your cost of capital, but then I start moving it down towards a mature company's cost of capital. You're saying, what's that going to be? US dollars right now? The median U.S. dollar cost of capital for U.S. companies between 7 and 7.5%. I'm not saying your company should have a 7 to 7, but if your cost of capital is 11% in year 10, and you call it a mature company and it's in U.S. dollars, I'm going to push back and say, that doesn't sound like a mature company to me. The growth rate has come down, but you've left the company as is in terms of being a high-risk company. So here are the things I'm going to change. I'm going to revisit the beta. My beta might be 1.8 in the high growth period, but it's going to move towards 1 in stable growth. I'm going to revisit your debt ratio. It might be close to 0 right now because you can't afford to borrow money, but I'm going to push it up towards a debt ratio you can sustain once you become a money-making company. Your return on capital might be 80% right now because you're a young company taking few projects, but once you get to be a mature company, that number has to move towards your cost of capital. Your company as a mature company bears no resemblance, other than the name, to the company that you're calling a growth company today. In my valuation of Snap, what I have for Snap in year one and what I have in year 10 are very different companies. In year one, I have a small money-losing company with lots of potential, lots of risk, almost no debt. In year 10, I have a company with $12 billion in revenues, $3 billion in operating profits, very different company, very different cost of capital, very different return on capital. Use the freedom you get within discounted cash flow valuation to change numbers. You're not locked in to what the numbers are in year one. So keep those four rules in mind. Let me review the rules. Cap the growth rate at the risk-free rate. Don't wait too long to make your company a mature company. Reinvest enough to sustain your growth rate. And to top it all off, make sure you give your company the characteristics of a mature company once it becomes a mature company. If you do that, your terminal value will stay in your control. If you don't do that, it's going to take over your valuation. It'll hijack your valuation. You could do everything right for 10 years and have it all wiped out because you let the terminal value get out of control. Which brings me to the next step in this process. So we've talked about cash flows, we've talked about growth rates, we've talked about discount rates, but we've also talked about discounting free cash flow to equity or free cash flow to the firm or dividends. We've talked about cost of equity and cost of capital. We've talked about high growth periods and stable growth periods. At this stage, you're saying, but I have to value one company. Which model should I use to value the company? So let's nail the answer to that question down. So you have a current cash flow, you have different discount rates, different growth rates. Let's talk about deciding which of these cash flows to discount. Should you be discounting dividends? Should you be discounting free cash flow at equity, free cash flow to the firm? Which discount rate should you be using? And what kind of growth pattern to use for your company? So let's start with the first question. Should you discount equity cash flows or firm cash flows? Equity valuation makes sense for companies where, with stable leverage, where the debt ratio is a number that you know and you think won't change. Why? Because you're going to see that valuing equity is, directly by taking free cash flow at equity and discounting the cost of equity is far easier when you have stable leverage. Or if the only thing you're focused on is the equity, like you do in banks and insurance companies. Okay? And with firm valuation is much more sensible if you're unsure about leverage. You don't even know whether the leverage is going to change, but you're unsure about what's going to happen. Or you know it's going to change. In the case of Snap, it makes no sense for me to do an equity valuation because I know the debt ratio is going to change. In fact, I will wager that for 80 to 90% of the companies that are being valued in this class, firm valuation makes a lot more sense than equity valuation because that leverage is still an unknown variable. But if you decide to go the equity valuation route, you decide that leverage is stable. You're valuing Verizon, which has a pretty stable debt ratio. You say, I can get away with equity valuation. You're faced with a second choice. Should I discount dividends or should I discount free cash flow to equity? They're both cash flows to equity. Which one should I use? Okay. If your company is a company where you cannot estimate free cash flows to equity, you have no choice but to do dividends. You say, when would I not be able to estimate? What do I need to estimate free cash flow to equity? I need net income. I need net capex. I need change in working capital and change in debt, right? For most companies, you should be able to do that. But if I gave you J.P. Morgan, do you see how much difficulty you're going to have estimating free cash flow to equity? You're going to start net income you can get. What's net capex for a bank? I don't know. What's change in working capital for a bank? It could be everything. It could be nothing. Can you imagine computing current assets and current liabilities for a bank? And change in debt? I mean, again, for a bank, 95% of the capital could be debt if you define deposits as debt. So you know what the last refuge of the dividend discount model is in valuing financial service companies. So if you're valuing a bank, an insurance company, an investment bank, it's almost desperation that drives you there. You cannot estimate any other cash flow, so what do? You discount dividends. And when you discount dividends, you are trusting managers to do the right thing, to pay out what they can afford to in dividends. Dangerous place to be. But that's the only dividend discount model I expect to see from this class. If you're valuing a bank, I can understand using dividends. Yes?
Why would you ever use the equity valuation?
Because in a sense, it's a little more honest, and I'll tell you why. If you have a lot of debt, I can make you look healthy on a free cash flow to the firm basis. Why? Because I'm looking at pre-debt cash flows. And because I'm looking at pre-debt cash flows, I'm missing the fact that every year you have a $2 billion deficit and you're not even going to make it. So sometimes, even if I don't decide to value the equity, I look at free cash flow equity because it gives me red flags that maybe this company will not make it. Right? So you're right. Most of the time when I have a choice, I value the firm. But sometimes I'll value the firm and also look at equity because it forces me to think about danger signals for this company. So if you can estimate free cash flow to equity, you should always use free cash flow to equity. If you cannot estimate it and you give up, then I can understand dividend discount model. So when you turn in your dividend discount model, I'm going to ask you, were you unable to compute free cash flow to equity? And the answer is yes, I'm okay with it. But if you are able to and you still use the dividend discount model, I think you've made the wrong choice. Okay? And finally, when you think about what discount rate to apply to the cash flows, it's already made for you, the decision. Because if you decide to go the equity valuation route, your cash flows are at equity, your discount rate has to be the cost of equity. If you're discounting cash flows to the entire firm, your discount rate has to be the cost of capital. So it's not even a choice. Your cash flow choices drive your discount rate choices. So which cash flow should you discount? Most of the time, the answer is you should just discount firm value, firm cash flows and value the firm. And if you decide to go the equity route, you come to the second branch, should you, dividends or free cash flow to equity. Which discount rate should you use? Depends on what cash flows you're discounting. Third and final question is about the growth patterns. Your company could already be a mature company. Don't go looking for trouble. It'll make your group mates incredibly jealous of you because you'll be done in like 5 minutes, right? Because you have a stable company, a mature company. What do you have to do? Just take the cash flow next year, divide by R minus G. And you're done. The whole class is over and you're going to be sitting there struggling. This other person in your group has a money-losing young growth company and they're projecting revenue growth and margins and you're at, no, I got that done a few weeks ago. But if you have a mature company, that's exactly what you should do. Stop the cash flows. Don't do it for the sake of doing it. You can value the company as a mature company. If your company is a pretty large company, a company like Coca-Cola, and you feel uncomfortable stretching the growth for 10 or 15 years, then give it a growth period because it'll give you some flexibility to adapt the numbers or adjust the numbers before they become a mature company. And if your company is a young company, you have no choice but to lengthen the growth period. And I might have told you this already, but I use 0, 5, or 10 as my growth periods for a company. 0 if you have a mature company, so no growth period needed. I do the terminal value right away. 5 if I have a company which is already large, but the growth is starting to move towards a stable growth rate. And 10 for any other company. I never go past 10 years simply because it's the exception, not the rule. So I think of discounted cash flow models like playing with Lego. Remember playing with Lego? Basically, you have three boxes, and you're fitting pieces together to create something. You got the cash flow box, the discount rate box, and the growth box. Every discounted cash flow model is some combination of the three boxes, right? Cash flow, a discount rate, and a growth pattern. That's why when people talk about hundreds of DCF models, they're missing the point. It's really not hundreds of models. It's basically combinations of different cash flows, growth, and risk. Just pick the one that's right for your company. That's half a valuation. Is kind of finessing the right model for your company. And I don't know what the right model for your company is, but it's something you got to work through. Think about your company before you make that choice. Any questions on model choices? Okay. Which brings me to the last part of all the stuff in DCF. I want to tie up some loose ends. What are the loose ends I'm talking about? To me, the danger in valuation is what you do after you tell me you're done. What I mean by that is people do a DCF, they come up with the value, and then they start doing strange things. Right? Add a premium for this, a discount for that, and add something else. Right? I'll tell you the genesis for this part of the presentation. About 12 years ago, you know how academia works in the US? I work incredibly hard. I have to teach like 4.5 hours a week. I get only the weekends off, and they give me only like 4.5 months every summer to do nothing. And because I work so hard, every seventh year I get the whole year off with pay. I'm sure, you know, when you go to work, you'll have something similar. It's called a sabbatical. It's very biblical. 6 years of work or partial work or kind of work. And the seventh year you get... So in fact, I'm due for my next sabbatical next year. I'm going in September for a year. My last sabbatical was 12 years ago. You're saying, why 12 years? Why isn't it 7 years? Because they kept pushing off my sabbatical. You can't leave this year. You can't leave this year. And finally I said, this year I'm leaving. Okay? So my last sabbatical 12 years ago, most people's sabbaticals have these big plans. They're going to write papers. They're going to do research. With my sabbatical, I had a singular objective. I wanted to spend an entire year doing absolutely nothing. Wake up every day for 365 days with a to-do list with nothing to do. And I have to admit, I got a little ostentatious about this. I went to Staples and bought one of those to-do. I stayed home, and above my little corner of my I can't call it my office because it's really not even mine, you know, but the corner of the room where I can work, I put the board up, And the first day of my sabbatical, I decided to flaunt it. So my kids, who were still in school then, came down the stairs to go off to school. And I pointed to my board and said, I have nothing to do today. I pissed them off to know when they left. But then I made my fatal error. My wife came down the stairs and said, Hannah, I have nothing to do today. She said, really? Why don't you start by walking the dog? So I walk the dog, I come back, there's something on my to-do list. I said, what the hell is this? It says, pick up bok choy at the grocery store. I'll make a confession. I didn't even know what bok choy was. I didn't even know what section of the grocery store to look at. I was too embarrassed to ask. After an hour and a half, I found it's like ugly-looking cabbage. Right? And I come back and say, pick up another item on my to-do list. And after the seventh or eighth time of my spouse putting to-do items on my to-do list, I said, I have to find something to do to keep her away from my list. So I started getting desperate for things to do. So I get an email from the editor of CFA magazine, a magazine I've never read. And he says, will you write a one-page article for a magazine? My usual response is, are you kidding me? I don't want to write a one-page article. But then I remembered I had nothing to do, and I needed something to do. I said, sure. And very big letters I wrote on my to-do list. Write one-page article for CFA magazine. Cannot pick up bok choy kids, etc., etc., etc. And I did write that article, and I have to tell you, it's the only thing I've ever written in my lifetime that's got me hate mail. You know how difficult it is to get hate mail in valuation? People don't feel strongly enough about anything to hate you. There's, I hate you for using bottom-up haters. I hate you for using implied premiums. It doesn't work that way, but this actually got me hate mail. First was the title. It said, Stop the Garnishing. And I was talking about the process in valuation where people finish doing a valuation, then they add 20% for control and knock off 35% for liquidity. You've got to stop doing this. Because if you do this, you're going to back into a number you wanted to see in the first place. It's not going to work. And I think I gave a story in that article that got me into real trouble. I might have used the word arbitrary for these premiums and discounts. It seemed, maybe that word pissed some people off. But I ended with a story about my second son. He's now 25. And, but his name is Brendan. And every birthday for each of our kids, we used to let them pick wherever they wanted to go to eat for dinner. And Brendan has very plebeian tastes. So right from the top, it was good when he couldn't talk. Because then we picked the restaurant for him and said, yes, Thai restaurant, perfect pick, Brendan. Of course, he was gurgling as a baby, so that's... As soon as he could talk, he made his pick. It was Burger King. His idea of a dream dinner was a supersized version of everything. What I'm trying to say is Brendan and flavor don't go together. He said, what you're doing is the equivalent of my taking Brendan to the most expensive Italian restaurant in town and ordering the most exotic pasta dish on the menu. Here's what would happen. The pasta dish would land up in front of him, be covered with all kinds of stuff, right? And his first reaction is, Dad, there's all kinds of stuff on my noodles. I'm not eating this. And the only way he'd eat it is if I took the pasta dish over to the sink, washed out every ounce of flavor, and served him some wet noodles. Think of what I've just done. I've spent $35 for a bowl of wet noodles. I could have done this at home. I said, that's what you're doing in DCF valuation. You're building these elaborate discounted cash flow models. Lots of flavor, toppings. And then what do? You wash out every ounce of flavor by taking 20% for control and 35% for liquidity. You got to stop this. Wave of hate mail starts. I actually created a smart mailbox to capture all the hate mail. It's actually one of the great things about the Mac. You can look for words, add them on. You see this word. I kept adding to the words, and hate mailbox got bigger and bigger. But one of the emails actually cut to the chase. It actually had a point that I think was legitimate. He said, it was from a private company appraiser, and he said, if you don't like what we're doing, why don't you come up with a better way of doing it? I was like, what? Dealing with control and liquidity and cash. So what I'm going to do is take you through that, because when that email came in, I said, you're right. I have 11 months left on my sabbatical, and here's what I'm going to do. Each month, I'm going to take a loose end. And I'm going to spend the entire month thinking about how would I value this loose end? Control, liquidity, employee options. So my dreams of doing nothing for a whole year got ruined, but in the process, half, one half of one of my books is basically those 11 months. So I'm going to take you through a very speedy review of some of those loose ends. Let's start with the simplest of all assets to value. I said, early on in this class, I said, if you are given an asset to value that is easy to value, it should be cash. And we talked about how $100 in cash is worth $100. Cash is one of the most mangled assets in discounted cash flow valuation for lots of reasons. It gets mixed up with other stuff. But I'm going to start off with a question. Is it possible in a company that you could see a company have $100 million in cash or $1 billion in cash and end up discounting the cash in the hands of that company? And if so, why? Is it possible for a different company to see $1 billion in cash and attach a premium to the cash? In other words, can we violate that very simplistic rule in valuation of don't mess with cash? Can you visualize companies where you might discount cash or add a premium to cash? Because I can, and I'll give you an example where I think you can see this happen. I'm going to show you three companies which look exactly the same in terms of enterprise value and the amount of cash they have. They all have $100 million in cash. They're all worth $1 billion. But here's where they're different. Company A and B are developed market companies. Company A earns a return on capital of 10%, has a cost of capital of 10%. Company B historically has earned a return on capital of 5% and has had a cost of capital of 10%. And Company C is an Argentine company that earns 10% more than its cost of capital. I'm going to argue that in one of these three companies, cash will be a neutral asset. You know what I mean by a neutral asset? It's going to be valued exactly $100 million. In one of these three companies, you will discount the cash. In one of these three companies, you'll attach a premium to the cash. So let's start with the easy question. Which of these three companies is cash going to be a neutral asset? And what is it about A that makes it a neutral asset? It's what I call a blah company. What do blah companies do? They don't hurt you. They don't help you. They just kind of run in place. You think, that's awful. There are fates far worse than having a blah company. In which of these three companies are you going to discount cash? What is it about B that scares you? It's their history, right? What do they have a history of doing? Stupid things. You're attaching a stupidity discount to the cash. You're saying, these guys are so stupid, they will find a way to ruin my cash. It's not the cash itself that scares you. It's what managers will do with the cash. And you're afraid, based on the history, that they will do bad things. You might discount the cash in their hands. And let's say Company C. It earns more than its cost of capital. What's the other half? It's in Argentina. You're saying, who cares? You know, in traditional corporate finance, no company needs a cash balance. Because if you have a great project, what do I assume you can do? Go to markets, raise the capital, take the project. What's the big deal? Now, do you see why I made this an Argentine company? There are at least five times in the last 15 years where the entire Argentine capital market is shut down. When I say entire capital market is shut down, equity markets no longer trade, banks have stopped lending. You think, so what? Let's say you're a company with a great project in a shutdown capital market. You can't take the project, right? Because you can't access cash. Now, do you see the advantage of having cash in a market like that? Because if you get into a crisis, not only will this allow you to take the great projects that come along, you might be able to buy other companies' assets for pennies in the dollar. So if you lived in a constrained capital market, I can understand why you accumulate cash. The only mistake I made in this example was I made in an Argentine company. I did this in Brazil about 2 years ago, and I showed exactly this example. So I asked, which is a neutral company, and they all said A. I said, which of these companies would discount the cash, and they all said C. I said, why? You know what their response was? Those Argentines, you can't trust them. That's a cultural thing. I have to, you know, be careful about where I show this example. But if you get past that Argentine mistrust, you can see why in emerging markets you might actually attach a premium to the cash. So cash looks simple until you start digging a little deeper. Okay? So should you ever discount cash? Yes. If you have a company with a history of taking bad projects, you might discount the cash. Should you attach a premium for the cash? Yes. If you have a small company in a capital-constrained environment, most of the rest of the time, don't mess with cash. And don't discount cash for stupid things like cash earns a low rate of return. That's not a good enough reason. It earns a low rate of return because it's invested in something riskless and liquid, not because it's a bad investment. Let me ask you a question. How much cash does Apple have? 250 billion. It's one third of the company. Should I discount that cash? That's really the heart of whether you'd invest in Apple or not. If your answer to that is no, then Apple is actually a really good investment because you're paying $130 per share, and $50 per share is actually cash. It's safe. So should I discount Apple's cash? What am I going to look at? I'm going to look at Apple's history of taking projects. I'm also going to look at Apple's history of doing really big, stupid deals. And you know what led me not to discount Apple's cash? Is you got to give Apple credit. $250 billion, you can buy anybody you want in the entire universe. You can buy entire countries. But they've restrained themselves, right? The biggest deal they might have ever done was the Beats acquisition, which was like penny change for them. $3 billion. They probably didn't even notice it was gone. You $250 billion cash, $3 billion slips out. Who notices that stuff? They haven't done $100 billion. The minute they do a big deal, I'm going to get... That's what's going to trigger my distrust in a company. I don't trust Microsoft. Why? Because they just spent $26 billion buying LinkedIn. I'm not saying it's a bad deal or a good deal. It's basically your worry about what will this company do with the cash. Yeah.
If you discount a premium, could that be double counting what you've already done your DCF?
No, this is actually separate. You're basically doing your DCF, do whatever you assume their operating assets will do. This is other stuff they can find with the cash. You're talking about going off the balance sheet, buying other companies, investing in new markets or new businesses, because your DCF, you're basically looking at your operating assumptions. This cash gives them the capacity. With Apple, I've kept them a smartphone company. But with $250 billion in cash, they could make it an entree into the automobile business. No, so they could go into new businesses. There is that always that risk of double counting, but the way I've done my operating cash flows, I don't think there is. This is actually for a separate issue. And with Apple, I would never attach a premium. Why? Because it has access to capital. So when you talk about attaching a premium, you're really talking about small companies where you're worried about survival. And this cash gives you some reason to believe that they will.
So if their CapEx expenditures in the past, though, include companies that they've done M&A on, that should be taken into account.
And I'd also look at the history of these acquisitions. If those acquired companies have been converted to profits very quickly, I'm okay with that. That's like any other project. But if they've done acquisitions that they've written off, like HP did, that's going to become a factor in whether I discount the cash or not. Yeah. Yes?
The premium and discount would be like a very easy way of playing a bias comment. So would you purely look at the history and say that this is worst case or best case?
I do it and only accept. That's actually a good point. The point was, you know, what's your name again?
Chuck.
As Chuck pointed out, if you get started on premiuming or discounting cash, you can very quickly start to build into your biases. Now, so I do it only in exceptional cases, right? So I would do it in HP. Definitely I will discount the cash because it scares the heck out of me. With Apple, I left it at $250 billion. Microsoft, if $100 billion is from cash, I'm going to be a little more wary about investing in the company if a big chunk of my value is coming from that cash. So I might not even have to discount. It might reflect whether I act on a valuation, right? Because if the value is $3 higher than the price, but $20 of the value is coming from cash, and a company has a bad track record, I'm one bad deal away from going underwater. So that's where it enters into the game. Now, I'm going to extend this concept of cash. And in fact, if you're thinking this is outlandish, does the market actually do stuff like this? I'm going to give you some evidence. The markets actually are discriminating when it comes to cash. They trust some companies with cash and others not so much. This is actually from a study that tried to look at how much the market valued a dollar in cash in the hands of a company. They looked across all companies. I'll give you the good news first. Across all U.S. companies, a dollar in cash is valued at a dollar. You know why that's good news? Because that's what we do in DCF valuation. Here's the bad news. When the study looked at mature firms with negative excess returns, what does that mean, negative excess returns? They're like company B, return on capital less than the cost of capital. A dollar in cash is valued at 69 cents. Think about that. There's a 31% discount attached to cash in these companies. And when you look at small companies, high growth companies with positive excess returns, a dollar in cash is actually valued at $1.22. Markets clearly don't view a dollar in cash as worth a dollar across companies. And if you think about activist investors, guys like Carl Icahn, you know what they're really good at? Let's face it, Carl Icahn is not the deepest thinker in the face of the earth, right? His modus operandi is he goes to a company and says, you have too much cash, give me the cash. You see why it works? If you have these companies where cash is discounted 31%, that's all you need to do to unlock value, right? Give the cash back. Because the minute you give the cash back, the discount goes away, and your stock price will effectively reflect that. So cash sounds easy until you start thinking about why might I not trust the managers of a company with cash? And once that comes into play, you can see why in some companies cash might be discounted. Now I'm going to extend this concept to another set of companies that are fairly unusual. They're called closed-end mutual funds. You know how mutual funds are organized in the U.S.? When you invest in a Fidelity mutual fund, how does it work? You send your money into the fund, they get your money, and they increase the number of units. So basically, if you look at what you get in the fund and the net asset value of the fund, the two are the same. You basically get your share of the overall value of the fund. That's how a typical mutual fund or an open mutual fund works. In a closed-end mutual fund, you actually invest in a company that runs the fund. You buy shares in the company. The company invests in shares in other companies. Basically, all they have is a mutual fund. Their assets are all publicly traded companies. So these should be the easiest of all companies to value, right? Because if you have four companies you hold, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, and Netflix, I'm not going to have to do any DCF valuations. I can add up the values of the four companies you have and say, I'm done. So you'd expect in closed-end mutual funds that when you look at your share price, you should have roughly your net asset value because everybody knows what the value is. But if you look at the actual numbers, closed-end mutual funds typically trade at a discount of 10 to 15% on the net asset value. In other words, you own $3 billion worth of stock as a company, and when you issue shares, then magically the value that is attached to the company is only 2.7 or 2.6 billion. In fact, when I first started learning finance, this was called the closed-end fund puzzle. Why is it a puzzle? Because it seems like easy money, right? Arbitrage. In what sense? What if you buy the entire company for $2.7 billion and then do what? Liquidate the company. You know, these are all publicly traded companies. You should be able to get $3 billion and claim the difference. There are lots of problems you might run into in going from targeting the company. But it seems like easy money to be made, and you say, why is there a discount? Let's think about that process a little more carefully, because I think that maybe the answer lies in looking at the most famous closed-end fund in history. It's a company called Berkshire Hathaway. You say, that's not a closed-end fund. What's the engine that provides the money for Berkshire Hathaway to invest? Where does the capital for their investment come from? It comes from an insurance company called GEICO, one of the largest insurance companies in the U.S., and it collects premiums. All insurance companies do it. They collect premiums, which you buy, you know, when you buy GEICO auto insurance, health insurance, life insurance, whatever it is, the premiums go to GEICO. Now, that's the way every insurance company, they collect the premiums, and then they invest the premiums. In most insurance companies, you don't attach any premium to the investment side because these guys are not great stock pickers. But in the case of Berkshire Hathaway, for much of its lifetime, you collected the insurance company capital, and who invested your money for you? Warren Buffett did. So if you look at Berkshire Hathaway's balance sheet, look at the assets out of the balance sheet, for much of its lifetime, most of its assets are publicly traded stocks, stocks like Coca-Cola, Washington Post. And if you add up the values of all of those stocks and you compare it to the value that you paid for Berkshire Hathaway, in the late 90s, here's what you were doing. If Coca-Cola was trading at $60 and you bought Berkshire Hathaway, you were effectively paying $120 for that $60 stock because Berkshire Hathaway market value was twice whatever you saw on its books. So now let me throw those two things at you. The typical closed-end mutual fund trades at a 15% discount. The most famous closed-end fund in history traded at a premium of 100% late 90s. And maybe I should give you one other piece of that you can use in this argument. That premium has gotten smaller and smaller since the late 90s, and now it's almost disappeared. It's almost similar to what it is for other insurance companies. So how do you connect all these different strands of facts together. What do you think explains all three? Why is a typical closed-end fund trade at a discount and Berkshire Hathaway trade at a premium? And why is the Berkshire Hathaway premium itself decreased over time? Do you remember what I said about the typical mutual fund and how much it beats the market by every year? What did I say about the typical mutual fund beating the market? It actually underperforms the market by 1.5%. So the typical mutual fund, they take your money and they actually give you 1.5%. So if the typical closed-end fund is run by a typical mutual fund manager, do you see why you discount the closed-end? Because you send the money in. Remember how we discount cash for stupidity? We send the money in. Now off the top, we say, these guys are going to manage to deliver 1.5% less. So part of the reason you explain the discount in a closed-end mutual fund is by pointing out that the typical mutual fund manager does not beat the market. Now, how do you explain the Berkshire Hathaway premium? You have the most famous mutual fund manager in the history of money management. A pretty good history, you think? Delivering more than the market? I think between 1964 and the 1990s, Berkshire Hathaway beat the market in all but 1 year. They deliver about 8% more than the market. So how does it translate? When you invest in Berkshire Hathaway, not only are you willing to pay for the stocks they bought, you're willing to pay a premium for the future stock picks that are going to be made. So that's why in the late 90s, Berkshire Hathaway traded at twice the net asset value. So why has that become 1.2 or 1.15? Why has that come down? How old is Warren Buffett? This is a very morbid thought. Warren Buffett is a human being. He's a great portfolio manager, but he's now, 87 years old, and he will die one day. And I'm not being mean. We all die. Which means if you're investing in Berkshire Hathaway, he's actually not involved in the day-to-day stock picks anymore. He's actually turned it over to Todd Combs. But to me, this is a reflection of the fact that investors are being sensible, saying, hey, Warren Buffett's not going to be picking stocks, even in the background, very much more. Do any of you own Berkshire Hathaway stock? If you do, you're paying for dinner for the rest of the semester because the share of Berkshire Hathaway costs like $225,000. So I said, just sell one share. We'll all eat dinner for the rest of the semester, right? But if you've invested in Berkshire Hathaway stock, this has been what's been hanging over the stock for the last 20 years, is your biggest asset. What's kept that price to book so high is, in a sense, fading each year. So think about closed-end funds and cash as an extension. Let's close today by looking at what I call the black hole of valuation. This is, to me, the most difficult case in valuation, and many of you may run into this. You're a company of cross-holdings in other companies. You have 10% of another company, 30% of a third company, 50% of a... So you have cross-holdings in other companies. And the way accountants account for cross-holdings is all over the place. In fact, in the U.S., there are three ways cross-holdings can be accounted for. If you own 3, 4, or 5% of another company and you take no role in how that company is run, it's called a minority passive investment. And if you have a minority passive investment, here's what you're required to do. In your income statement, below the operating income line, you have to show the dividends you receive from these cross holdings. And in your balance sheet, you have to show what you originally invested to get that cross holding. So minority passive, you show dividends in the income statement, original investment in the balance sheet. You can already see how disconnected this number can be from reality. In the late 90s, you heard of SoftBank, the Japanese venture capital firm? In the late 90s, there was a point in time where 70% of SoftBank came from one holding it had, a holding in Yahoo, where it was a venture capitalist, an early venture capitalist. So it invested $50 million in a very young Yahoo. That $50 million had become $7 billion in market value. And if you looked at SoftBank's income statement, what do they need to show from that holding? It was classified as minority passive. You have to show the dividends they were receiving from Yahoo, which in the late 90s was nothing. So in the income statement, you saw nothing. Then you went to the balance sheet, and you saw a $50 million value. That was the original $50 million they invested in Yahoo. The value is now $7 billion. It's completely disconnected, minority passive. Let's move one step up the ladder. You own 20, 21% of another company. You take some role in how the company is run. You have a director on the board. It's called a minority active investment. You're supposed to use what's called the equity approach. record this holding. What's the equity approach? In your income statement, below the operating income line, you have to show 20% of the net income or net loss. So no longer dividends, at least you're moving to something more sensible. And in your balance sheet, you have to show what you originally invested, adjusted for retained earnings since. So it's like an updated book value. A little better than minority passive because at least you're updating. And then you get to 60% of another company. What are you required to do? I've never understood it, but accountants seem to require that you do this. You own 60% of another company. What are you required to do? You're required to consolidate. What does consolidation mean? You have to act like you own 100% of that company. So here's what happens. When you do your income statement, the accountant says, act like you get 100% of that company's revenues. You say, but I own only 60%. He says, don't worry about it. Then you get to the balance sheet. You get to the assets. He says, count 100% of the assets. Yeah, I own only 60%. He says, don't worry about it. Then you get to there, act like you have 100%. I own only 60%. He says, don't worry about it. The last moment, the accountant wakes up and says, but you own only 60%. He says, that's what I've been trying to tell you all this time. You don't own 40%. Exactly. Well, we have to show the 40% that doesn't belong to you on the balance sheet to make it all equate. Hence is born the worst named item on the balance sheet. You know what it's called? Minority interest. Sometimes called non-controlling interest. It'll show up on the liability side of the balance sheet. Why is it there? Because I made you count 100% of the subsidiary and you don't own 40%. The minority interest is the accountant's estimate of the 40% that doesn't belong to you. The biggest challenge with cross-holdings is first figuring out how they're accounted for. Because now with IFRS and JV, joint venture accounting, it's all over the place. And in most companies, that is where you will get stuck, is trying to figure out what to do about the cross-holdings. So when we come back on Monday, we're going to talk about valuing cross-holdings and the rest of the loose ends. But if you haven't picked up your quiz, please pick it up soon because it might disappear.
Once you classify leases as debt, from that point on, whenever you talk about total debt anywhere in valuation, the total debt should include the lease.
Depreciation is not based on your cash flow, right? right? There's still a dead giveaway. We look at fixed assets. As long as we fix assets, we look at fixed assets. Right? So you can't make it go to zero. If you use any number other than zero, I'd have been okay.
Yeah.
So if you said, look, I think it'll drop to 150 because the capex is dropping, I'd say, okay. But if you make it zero, it's almost like you're ignoring the balance sheet. Right?
That makes sense. All right, thank you.
Hi, how are you? Oh, it should be in the income statement. And what shows up in the balance sheet is what you originally invested to get the home.
Okay.
I should fix that.
And so for the equity approach,
that shows up in the income statement. The percentage of your profit or loss will show up in the income statement.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Good. I just have a real quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Just a thought I can see to I remember last year you talking about someone in the presentation asked, can you assume confidently that the optimal capital structure is 40% then 60% equity? And you said depending on the company and the capital market. So does the company grow to stable growth? I'm assuming the capital structure goes from being mostly equity to
some debt.
Their optimal capital structure.
It doesn't have to be optimal. It could be industry average. There's nothing that pushes companies towards the optimal, right?
Okay.
So they're a tech company, they might push up only to 15% because even mature tech companies don't get to 40 or 30. They often stop at 10 or 15.
So my question would be, I guess, what is the fundamental reason why as companies grow even after this, why wouldn't they use more of the debt? Like, why isn't Apple?
Because you're ignoring the tax benefits from debt. Why did Apple borrow money? They didn't need the cash, right? You're leaving the tax advantage on the table when you don't have it. You're not borrowing the money because you need the cash. You're borrowing the money because there's a tax advantage, and now you have the earnings to cover the interest.
That's
so
what I was missing. Okay, awesome. All right, thank you.